welcome to June, two peas in a podcast, halfway through the year, Trevor.
Yeah, I know. We've done a couple of winter ones before, I noticed, when I was looking back over the old podcasts. So this is not our first winter podcast.
Definitely not. We're quite, what's the word we were becoming?
Repetitive.
That's not the word I was thinking. What's the word? Stalwarts. We're just becoming. Yeah, I tell
we'll
you what.
We'll think of the word later.
2 o'clock in the morning.
We had 32 millimetres of rain. I've got a rain gauge now.
Oh, love it.
And it was 30 sort of the week before, and there's another big monsoon coming down from the Indian Ocean, so it's wet out there for a change.
Which I absolutely love, and I, last weekend for the long weekend, did some planting, a little bit late, but then...
Tell us what you did.
I planted spinach, potatoes. Yep. I had beautiful patch of potatoes, which listened to the podcast from last time, and lots of that fabulous green manure, and I've also planted... I've still got heaps
broad
of
beans
sorrel.
You did.
I didn't do broad beans.
I
always do broad beans. I didn't this year. But I did do lettuce, broccoli, cauliflower. I did a lot of the staples, actually. I actually chose to just do a lot of the staples this year. Oh, and beetroot. Because homegrown beetroot is a bit like homegrown potato. People say things like, oh, really, homegrown beetroot? Is it worth the effort? I really think it is. I think homegrown beetroot is just beautiful, and the leaves, I chuck them through a salad as well. So it's one of those fabulous vegetables that, you know, kind of the top and the bottom. I will put some beans in only because they make me feel very successful.
Yeah, well, actually, we quite like the fresh broad beans. If you pick them when they're green, which you've got the choice when you're growing your own, and you can pick them a bit young. And so when they're green, they're actually very nice indeed. But in a role reversal, you and I've started planting flowers.
I know. So when I messaged Trevor and I said, guess what I've planted? And then the heavens opened up all week, which was very, very kind.
Yeah.
I bought 4 new ducks.
What?
I know. I bought 4 new ducks. I've got 6 now.
Okay.
I was very excited, but I bought 4 new ducks. And then Trevor's messaging me, well, actually, I'm planting flowers. I'm like, oh, my gosh.
So we didn't really do what we'd said we'd do. But, well, to tell you the truth, there's a little bit of serendipity here in that I bought a lot of manure. I bought 5 cubic yards of chook manure. And it was a big heap, you know. It was more than 30 wheelbarrow loads. And I was taking my time using it, and I thought, well, this stuff really smells bad, you know. Like, it gets into your hair, and then you take it into your pillows at night, and you got to wash your sheets and everything, you know. So I thought I'd put it in the 2 empty compost bins that I had and put some green stuff on top. So we got what we call the mowing heap, where all the grasses are thrown in a heap, and I run over it with the lawnmower. And as I was doing that, this smell of artemisia came out. And I thought, geez, that's medicinal. That's very nice. That will squash the smell of the manure. And then I ran into these lemons and limes that were windfalls on the ground. And I started cutting them up with the lawnmower. And they smelt too. And then I did rosemary and lavender, which were also on the heap. So if you're bored with mowing your sanitary, uninteresting lawn, you could just throw artemisia over it and make it very aromatic, because the smell goes into the air when you mow it. So I did eventually get rid of the smell of the manure, and I buried a lot of it for future storage, for future usage in the compost bin. So that's a good thing to do over winter, because, you know, the rain comes on top of it, you squash the weeds. It gets incorporated into the soil so that when you come to plant your tomatoes, you've got this high phosphate fertiliser already in place and ready to go.
Yeah, which is a fabulous idea. I put my hardcore chook manure in the compost bin as well, because, it's too full on. But then I've got a bit of a separate pile where I've got the hay from the chook shed, but I put it separately and kind of break that down a bit before I put up the fruit trees. Everyone gets a bit overexcited with chook manure, and then they put it straight on the garden. Don't do that.
No, it is best to lay it out now into the vacant land.
Yeah.
Well, I did 5 beds with this manure, and I bought what I call time poor straw, right? So these people where I used to take my trailer out to Roadworthy and get the pea straw off, they got burnt out during the pinery fire. And now they've got a new product which is wrapped in plastic, and it's chopped up pea straw.
Oh, fabulous.
It is, actually, because, I mean, it costs too much, I agree, but it costs less than the sugarcane mulch and the other one that they sell. But one thing about it, it's really quick, you know, like you open the plastic bag and you just put it on the soil, there's nothing else to do. Yeah. So I put that on top of the manure and it looks beautiful too. Of
course. It does look really nice. You know I love straw around the plants. It always looks really neat.
Yeah, that's right.
It looks like you've really gardened.
Yeah, and the plants are usually green and the straw is usually yellow, so it's a nice colour contrast too.
Which is really good and keeps all that stuff in.
Yeah, and I had to prune quite a lot of things, including Jerusalem artichokes and ossify, which is a herb that comes up everywhere when you planted it, and lemon balm.
I love lemon balm. It's one of those fabulous ones where it's a bit like nasturtium. You plant it and it just goes bananas, but it doesn't feel intrusive because it's quite easy to kind of weed areas of it, and it smells
divine. It is fairly ugly this time of year, and so pruned it back hard, and so now it's all that's left is the green part because it had all the brown stalks hiding the green part. But I planted that out, so like yours, I'm probably going to be successful because everything that you plant now and transfer now, and this is a hint for those who want to transfer fairly large plants, that you can actually almost bare root them and put them in the ground, and with the rain everywhere, there's no evaporation, so there's no transpiration, and so you're getting water every day from the sky, and things just seem to transplant well, you know.
I've transplanted a bay tree from a pot into the garden. I know, and I have to keep it small because bay trees are very deceptive. My sister-in-law has this massive bay tree, and I think people run away from her now because they get these giant branches of bay leaves, which is sort of hysterical because I always think you go to the supermarket and you get these six little dried up sad leaves in a packet, and the bay tree is actually planted in the right spot, prolific, and interestingly enough, one of my favourite additions to cooking. I think it's really underutilised. But I transplanted that into the garden, into a spot where I will be able to keep it small because you do have to be a bit mindful. They can suddenly take over. But all that sort of stuff we're doing at the moment. But we thought this month we'd talk about something a little bit sidesteppy from the garden. Trevor is amusing me. He is indulging me.
No, we did say we'd do garden ornaments.
Garden ornaments. Things you put in the garden that are, I guess, effectively non-living. And I've been thinking about this a bit lately because my mum and stepfather recently moved to a lifestyle village, not a retirement village, Trevor, a lifestyle village. And I tell you what, amazing. It's certainly been an incredibly positive move for them. They're both still very vibrant and active, and it's been amazing. But they had this experience where there are no fences between houses, which is delightful. And they had their house next to them had the most beautiful natural rose hedge. So it was like a screen. The roses were divine. Anyway, unfortunately, the roses got ripped out. Now, this was despite much protestation from the committees, but it still happened. Then, Trevor, my mother was coming home with my daughter-in-law, so with her granddaughter-in-law from shopping, and they gently curved around the bend of the lifestyle village because you're only allowed to do 5 kilometres an hour.
Oh, that's right.
And they gently curved around the bend, and as she came towards her house, the rose hedge, which had been removed, which offered some privacy, had been replaced by approximately 30 garden gnomes.
Gnomes. Wow.
Now, I'm not going to lie to you. When I came round the corner and saw them, I was hysterical because I knew how cross my mum and stepfather would be. But since then, we've been having these amazing discussions about what actually constitutes appropriate garden ornaments and when does it cease to become a garden? Like, you know, I can see here on your list, you've got things like ponds. Well, I actually think all gardens should have some kind of a pond because they do. They attract the birds, the insects, the lizards. Definitely in our climate, absolutely we need to have ponds for our wildlife and just that lovely evaporation so that our backyard doesn't actually feel dry.
Yep.
But what other things constitute appropriate ornaments? Because I've been having this discussion with people and I just did not realise it was such an impassioned subject.
Yeah, well, as you know, I'm in front of my home theatre quite a lot, and I quite like YouTube because you can get untold information, and those big English estates or the aristocracy, they would have the most, well, everything about them was superb and ridiculous, and you know, most of the chimneys, you could have bought a poor person's house for the price of the chimney, and they had 100 of them. But they also indulged in garden statuary and structures, like follies and like mausoleums, and like they found a whole lot of usage for, you know, tea houses and the like, because there were Japanese influences at that time. So there's the other extreme, you know, you go from Nome to having a garden shelter or something like that. So there is a lot of things that can be classified as non-living garden, you know.
That's true. And my son's grandfather was a great fan of building a gazebo. And he didn't pass away until he was well into his 90s. And he was fortunate enough to be very fit and active. So he was building gazebos right to the very end. And no house of theirs was without its gazebos. But how delightful to be sitting in this gazebo, enjoying the garden. So yeah, you're right. My neighbour moved to a smaller property and they had a beautiful wrought iron two-seater bench. Yep. And they sort of said to me, we really would like you to have it. We want it to go into a really nice garden. Mm. Forms a beautiful backdrop to the end of a path that I've got, which is lovely. And I have my pride and joy in my garden is, you know, I've got the beginnings of a dry riverbed, but I already bought a beautiful wrought iron lizard that I've perched on a rock.
Yep.
So there are these delightful bits that I guess are almost serendipitous, where you kind of come across things in the garden. So you've got your big sculptures or your big non-living things, and then there's all those delightful things where you come across and you think, oh, look at that. Well, you know,
it's even more diverse than that, really, because remember, Chris and Doug, they had all their memorabilia inside their flat. And when they bought their own place, they moved it out into the garden. That looks quite good, doesn't it?
It looks amazing. And it's that real trick, though, because I often joke with Trish, if I did it, it would look like I dropped a box of things that I was moving.
Yep.
But they have this way of really presenting it that is just beautiful. So I jokingly was going to purchase a garden gnome for my stepfather, which had a rather rude sign on it in response to the ones next door. But then he was given at Christmas time by my daughter-in-law's friend Liam this gorgeous little echidna, which just is delightful, kind of, it kind of peeks out from amongst the Banksia. So it's this gorgeous little kind of like, oh, wow, look at that, you know. But then, yeah, is there a snobbery?
Well, no.
Is there snobbery in it? I don't know.
I think what we're saying is that there's a huge variety that a lot of people don't think about, like, I have honoured my word and kept the sweet peas up. So I've got sweet peas that are about 300-400 mil off the ground and growing on trellises. So trellises, there's lots of them. You know, there are those sort of teepee tripod made out of tree branches. And I actually, what started this topic was you were walking past one of my what are called standards. That is, they got a post and then they develop into a ball. And so you can do a topiary. And see, topiary, I suppose, is a way of garden ornaments too. Probably quite a big one, you know.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things that come under this category. One of our friends, she's got one of these big modern houses on a fairly small block, and the two courtyards that she's got, they're just full of Buddha statues. And there's other people who say, well, we've got a Murray magpie, whatever you call a mudlark in other states, a small magpie that's attacking all of our windows. And I was really surprised when somewhere I was listening to something or reading something about a garden and the person said, well, we put our mirror out in the garden. So people put mirrors in the garden.
Yeah.
I mean, the mirror thing is something that it does give you a reflection, but it also apparently gets rid of these mad Murray magpies.
I'm just thinking of, you know, the fabulous gardens of the, you know, the old Italians and the Greeks in the 1960s, and they would have all these bizarre kind of ornaments where they would be giving things a new life, and I guess there'd be the mirror out the side and some old pot or a pan in the corner. And I guess now we think of that as really posh, but back then it was just really giving something a new life and reutilising it, you know.
Well, yeah. A lot of farmers do the old harvesting material, you know. Like yes, they've got a true. Great big yeah. set of tines or something that they park in their garden, and that becomes, like Trish and Dave, that becomes a memorial to the past too. Yeah. So you can bury history in your garden. But a really modern one is the fire pit.
Oh, which I will be purchasing very soon. And a friend at work had a fire pit.
Yeah.
And she was very excited. Where she just got a not a very expensive one, but she's having a wonderful time with it.
Well, I mean, it gets you outdoors. It gets you sitting around a
bonfire.
Yeah, and it does remind you of your camping days and that sort of thing. And you're outdoors and looking at the stars. And a friend of mine has just put one row of bricks. So you do a bit of a concrete slab. Admittedly, he's a builder, and so he does a good one. And then you do a circle. I mean, probably the internal clear space has to be at least 750 millimetres or 2'6" in the old language. And then you just put it one brick high, because the fire pit often goes wrong in that the heat doesn't get on your feet and on your toes and that. It's too high.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And they often have to bring in air, so they've got these pots that they build that are too high, and then they have to cut openings in it so the air can get into the fire. Because any rate, if you just put one row of bricks down, it works pretty well. It's very much like a campfire.
Well, I like that idea, actually. That's an excellent point. And I guess with the fire pit too, it's once again that thing of where you're utilising time that you wouldn't necessarily spend in the garden. You know, in winter.
You're not thinking of sitting down drinking wine.
I am. Okay, I'm going to confess. I'm thinking of having, excuse me, mulled wine. It's winter. You know, where you're sort of sitting around and having a glass of wine and enjoying a bit of a fire. So I guess the other things that you've got down here are like the rose arch. Well, I've got a couple of arches in my garden, and I had never really thought, well, actually, this. I guess sculptures and garden ornaments add a sense of structure.
Yep.
To a garden.
Very true.
Which I think is really positive. You've got here paths and edges. Well, actually, they're non-living things. I'm building up a dry riverbed as my paths. But realistically, that's a structure. And my niece and I attempted. The current trendy thing is to get old plates and you sort of silicone them together to make flowers that you put on a stick and you put them through the garden.
Right.
You know, so I think used well, ornaments can be really delightful.
I think you got it right when you said, you know, planning and composition and stuff like that. I mean, we're probably both aware that you put your high plants at the back and your low plants in front.
Yeah.
But there's more to planning than that. So there is sort of, I think it's called, I've forgotten the name, but you can have disclosure and openness, you know, like you can actually hide parts of the garden and you walk through an opening and there is a new garden.
Oh, lovely,
so you can have
yeah.
garden rooms and that sort of thing. Well, it's not exactly ornaments, but you can see how you must plan, and ornaments will be part of your planning because they do represent a focal point. People, it's a talking point sort of thing.
I think so. Like my auntie recently purchased 6 delightful small metal 2D rabbits in different dancing poses. So she's one of 6 sisters, and our last name's Kleinenberg, which means rabbit burrow. So we love rabbits. Just it looks gorgeous. Yep. She's a brilliant horticulturalist. They're dancing around the edge of this garden bed, and it's like she's not hugely into those kind of garden structures, but it's a really planned, purposeful part of the garden, and I think it looks utterly gorgeous.
Yeah, so I mean, I just put in a rain gauge, and that sits on a post on its own. That's not. But on the other hand, it's on a corner, so you can get to it easily and so forth. So it did need some planning, you know.
Yeah.
So all of these things, they do need a bit of planning. And like you say, the paths, the finishes on the paths, you know, whether well, this time of year, if you got clay, you're going to slip.
Yeah.
So you do need a topping on your paths, I think. You need sort of dolomite or sawdust or something like that so you don't go slipping everywhere. And those paths do need to be the drainage, I think. So you're also talking this time of year of looking at what you've got and seeing where the puddles form, because it is rainy. And so, yeah, drainage is a good time of year to study that. And I have to repeat myself there, because there's a lot of people who say, oh, yeah, and then don't do it, because it's actually, well, a lot of it's hidden. It's not, yeah, it's not productive like ornaments are. At least ornaments, you can see them, you know.
Yeah, that's true. But a beautiful path. Like, I love at the botanical gardens those beautiful sawdust, is that what they are? The sawdust paths.
Yeah, that's right.
They're just gorgeous and done well. There can be the not well garden ornament, I'm not going to lie. I'm not a fan of the giant fountain. But, you know, once again, it's like with anything to do with the garden. What one person loves, another person doesn't. And it really... gardening is about creating that beautiful haven, you know, and you kind of see garden spaces where there are almost more ornaments than there are plants. And I can be a terrible garden snob, and I'll be like, oh, that's not a proper garden. But then I think, well, you know what, if you're out there and you're sitting and you're enjoying it, who's to say what should or shouldn't be?
Yeah, I don't think you can pass judgment on other people.
I can pass judgment, I just shouldn't.
Well, if that's the end of that subject there, I mean, we also said we'd talk a little bit about winter planting. Now, we've said on other podcasts that there is the permanent crops of strawberries, asparagus, rhubarb and artichokes to go in, so we won't repeat what you do about them. But if you have got a very nice patch of fertile ground... Well, strawberries are a very good one, because the ones you buy are sort of cardboardy, so they're a crop in which I recommend it's actually a necessity to have it. The homegrown stuff, because the stuff that they've produced, weirdly enough, is produced for long shelf life and perfect appearance, and they forgot about taste, you know.
Forgot about taste. Which... Although I was at a baby shower, my niece's baby shower the other week, where... somebody had actually gotten hold of some pretty decent strawberries. They weren't too bad, but they dipped them in pink chocolate, or they had made the white chocolate pink in honour of the baby shower. They were quite delicious, but not entirely true to form.
And also, I suppose we should say that on behalf of the Gawler Broadcasting Association, we are this year selling some heirloom tomatoes. Now, tomatoes are the same as strawberries in that if you buy them, they are a bit like sort of cardboard balls with a photograph of a tomato on them, because once again, they've done the same thing, you know. The heirlooms are the only ones that I knew for about 50 years of my life. So it's the modern ones that are the oddball, surprisingly, because they've come up with these things that are perfect for what the supermarkets want, which is long shelf life and perfect appearance. But they've lost their taste. So if you agree with that, and you should, well, then you can probably get some heirloom tomatoes from us in about September.
Which would be fabulous. We're going to have a working bee. Look on the website, because we'll do a bit of a video of the working bee. And we're quite excited. So I've already spoken to a few people who are... We've already got some orders in, Trevor.
Oh, yeah, well...
We have some orders in, Trevor. So the heirloom tomatoes are delightful. It is really important. So they are the Brandywine Red, the Tigerella, which is just so beautiful. You can just sit there and stare at it. The Romas, which last year were a huge hit.
Yep, they're popular.
The Black Crim, which are sort of big, and they're almost a blackish.
Yeah, well, there are those sort of blackish Russian ones, and that is one of them. They taste very nice. They taste a bit like sort of smoked almonds or something.
Yeah, they are delicious. The Mortgage Lifter, which are fantastic. Well,
actually, sorry, that has been cancelled.
That has been cancelled? Yeah. Oh, I apologise profusely. The Black Crims, though, what they can do as well as the Mortgage Lifter is they make a beautiful stuffed tomato. Slice off the top.
Yeah, they are the ones that used to be called Housewife's Choice. See?
Now we call them House Person's Choice, Trevor.
Yeah, I know.
We're moving forward, Trevor.
Well, I agree. I like it particularly because it's got a real bias against men. But so, yeah, they are beautiful tasting things. I mean, last year, surprisingly, we didn't advertise the fact that we were heirloom, but a lot of them were, including the Rouge de Maman. And they are a dwarf tomato, which no one really requested much, but I put the leftover ones in just a bed and I forgot about them, and they produced the most of any of them.
I know. Mine went bananas. Mm. And look, I always have this idea that I'm going to preserve them, but I'm a prolific giver awayer of these things. And
you're a good woman.
I know. And I love the idea of like kind of picking them and just leaving like a bowl on my neighbour's table. My neighbour and I have a table each at the front of our houses, and it's always this delightful little surprise what I come home to or what she gets to come home to. So these are the four types that will be ready in September. Five. And so we'll do some advertising on the Facebook page, and you're welcome to pre-order. But look, there's something about tomatoes, Trevor, that even if you don't love eating them, you've got to love growing them.
Yeah, people don't forget tomatoes. I mean, I don't really have to advertise tomatoes. I think everyone who grows a garden has got to have tomatoes. There is something exciting about getting a good crop too. Well, I mean, there are a lot of things you can think about planting. We're a bit late with our recommendation for planting flowers. When September comes around, there's a mass of plants you can plant. You know, there are things like corns and melons and cucumbers and capsicums. There's a whole host of stuff that all becomes busy and necessary all at once in September. So it is good to have the tomatoes taken care of as a seedling rather than trying to start them, because you'll be a bit late normally.
You will be.
Yeah,
and plus, you know, part of what we're doing too is raising some funding so that you can get these podcasts, access to these podcasts, which is really important. So we will be advertising these on the Facebook page. They will not come with ornaments, but that's okay. And we love it when people share what they've grown. So what are we going to talk about next month, Trevor?
Well,
July is a funny month. It's winter, but we're kind of heading into the warmer months.
Yeah, well, you could talk about soil. You can always talk about soil. I mean, soil and life in the soil is the key fundamental of gardening, but we didn't really have much to talk about this time, so I think we can leave it open and we'll probably come up with only 30 minutes of discussion anyway.
I think you and I will always come up with 30 minutes of discussion, Trevor. Yeah. So we look forward to seeing you next month. So thank you from Michelle.
And goodbye from Trevor.